You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Blake and Ulig, PA, and Boyd, Kenter, Thomas, and Parrish, LLC. Blake and Ulig, PA, and Since 1983, Boyd, Kenter, Thomas, and Parrish firm has emphasized its efforts in all types of labor law, union-related claims, and employment law disputes. The attorneys at BKTP have the experience and expertise to represent those who have been injured or killed in the workplace for hundreds of clients in both Missouri and Kansas. Visit our website at BKTP Law to contact us for a free consultation. And Blake and Ulig, PA, has been serving the labor community as union lawyers for many decades. The Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI thank our underwriters for their support. Tonight on the show, we explore a new book called Politics of the Pantry, which tells the history of protest of the high cost of food by working and middle-class American housewives. Now that our food chain is in danger, will we see a resurgence of food activism? Then, we talk to labor activist Jessica Padola. She tells us what she learned from the 2018 Right to Work fight and says, when labor puts their differences aside, we can accomplish a lot. In the news, it's all about workers as guinea pigs and throwaways in the pandemic. Our feature at the end of the show is Know Your Rights with Angie Williams. Now for the news. This week's news will focus on workers as guinea pigs and throwaways of the pandemic. Our first story comes from labor journalist David Bacon, who reports on Apple workers in the state of Washington who are guest workers under the H-2A program. Last week, we interviewed Baldemar Velasquez about the strenuous efforts his union, Flock, is taking to protect guest workers coming in to work tobacco and vegetable crops in the Southeast and Midwest. It appears that the workers Bacon reports on in Washington lack such support from a union. Bacon reported today that on March 12th, an H-2A visa guest worker living in a Stemmelt grower's barracks in Mattawa, Washington, began to cough. He called a hotline, was tested, and found out that he had COVID-19. He and five of his co-workers were then kept in the barracks for the next 2 weeks. A month later, three STEM-lit H-2A workers in the barracks in East Wenatchee began to cough, too. Before their tests even came back, three more started coughing. Soon, they and their roommates were all in quarantine. Dr. Peter Rutherford of the Confluence Health Clinic called STEM-lit and suggested that they test all 63 workers in the barracks. 38 tested positive. Then, some of those workers who tested negative began to test positive, too. Since the H-2A workers infected in the Stemlett barracks arrived in February and didn't manifest symptoms until March and April, they must have contracted the virus in the U.S. Guest workers, therefore, are getting infected once they arrive. The novel coronavirus continues to spread throughout central Washington. By mid-May, rural Yakima County had 1,203 cases, 122 reported on May 15th alone, and 47 people had died. The county has the highest rate of COVID-19 cases on the West Coast, 455 cases per 100,000 residents. According to Familias Unidas por la Justicia, a farmworker union, workers at six work sites in Yakima County have now shut down production. They are demanding two main things for those who decide to continue working during the pandemic: safer working conditions and an extra $2 an hour in hazard pay. Two have now begun a hunger strike. The strikes are women-led, multi-generational, and multiracial. Meanwhile, thousands more H-2A guest workers are scheduled to arrive in the area first for the cherry harvest and then to pick apples.
In Kansas meatpacking plants, people are working who have been exposed to the virus. According to today's Kansas City Star, the state of Kansas relaxed its quarantine guidelines at the urging of the large meatpacking companies. The Star made a Freedom of Information request of text and email messages between the Kansas Department of Agriculture and the Department of Health and Environment and industry executives. They show that as the number of workers who tested positive for COVID-19 climbed, Tyson and National Beef executives pushed Kansas Secretary of Agriculture Mike Beam to lower his standards in favor of new weaker ones of the Center for Disease Control. So far, nearly 2,000 people in Kansas have been infected with the virus, and six people have died, according to the Star. As of May 2nd, meatpacking employees who have come into close contact with positive cases may continue to work as long as they show no symptoms and take precautions like wearing a mask. Before, they were asked to quarantine for 2 weeks. It's unclear whether this applies to the unionized plants in Kansas. Martin Rosas, president of UFCW District Local 2 that represents meatpacking and grocery workers in Missouri and Kansas, including the workers at the Triumph plant in St. Joe and plants in Dodge City and Liberal, have been demanding enforceable standards to protect workers since March. This week, he was interviewed by the Congressional Hispanic Caucus and complained that Trump's order to invoke the Defense Production Act to keep meatpacking plants open did nothing to protect the workers. The union has negotiated to make the CDC guidelines mandatory and has gotten sick pay in some facilities and hazard pay of $2 to $6 an hour. They have also won reduced line speeds. Rosas is concerned, however, that the non-union plants, the local, state, and federal authorities are not requiring mandatory measures to protect workers.
Yesterday, McDonald's workers in 20 cities nationwide went on strike, protesting against the company's response to the virus pandemic and demanding guaranteed paid sick leave, hazard pay, and more. Hundreds of employees of the fast food giant from Los Angeles to Detroit to Miami participated in the strike, and some walking off the job, mainly simply not going to work. On a HuffPost video call, workers expressed many concerns, including lack of protective gear and McDonald's failures to notify workers if a coworker had tested positive for coronavirus. Darnell Harris, a grill worker at a Detroit McDonald's, said, "Since the pandemic started, folks have been quitting because they're scared of getting sick, but I have no choice. I keep going to work because I'm living check to check. I have college debt and medical bills." While McDonald's has provided 2 weeks of paid sick leave and cash bonuses to workers in its cupboards during the pandemic, it does not guarantee such leave and benefits to workers at its independently owned franchises, which make up 90% of the thousands of locations nationwide. A Los Angeles worker said a fellow worker was hospitalized with the virus, and the McDonald's only gave the worker 4 days off for quarantine. Without adequate PPE, she decided to send her kids to her mother-in-law so as not to expose them. Fran Marion, a McDonald's worker in Kansas City, Missouri, pointed out on the call that the coronavirus has disproportionately been killing Black, Latino, and Native American people. Black and Latino workers are overrepresented in the service industry, including in restaurants and retail jobs. I'm human just like you, Marion said, adding that McDonald workers deserve protective gear and hazard pay. I may not be a doctor or a paramedic, but I'm out here on the front lines just like them. I deserve to be treated like a human, and that's why I'm going on strike. Kansas City food workers at Wendy's, Burger King, Arby's, and McDonald's struck yesterday.
And that's the news from our side. We had one more story about the KC tenants, and we will put it on our Heartland Labor Forum Facebook page. The news tonight was read by Greg Swartz, Joyce McCauley, and I'm Judy Ansel.
Masks, gloves, soap, scrubs, TikTok, Grubhub, Twinks, Jocks, Bears, Cubs, Zoom is the new club. 6 feet, no hugs, still beat these mugs. Sick beat, cut a rug, Joe Exotic is a bug. Kitty cat cat, tell me Carol Baskin, where is the husband? Everyone's asking. Stimulus check, everybody better cash in. Mask and gloves, yeah, that's the new fashion. Girl, what did that girl just say, girl? Ooh. Girl, I don't go to work, work. I don't leave, I stay, stay. I don't care, I eat, 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 and sleep all day. Okay. And then I watch TV. Yeah, that's just the tea on TV. Yes, ma'am.
Good evening. That was Mask, Gloves, Soap, and Scrubs by Tarek Fall. And it certainly does fit our topic tonight as we talk about politics of the pantry. We want to welcome, I'm Joyce McCauley, and we're going to welcome Emily Tarek, author of Politics of the Pantry. She's an assistant professor of labor studies and American history in the School of Labor and Employment Relations at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Her book demonstrates how the political activism affected American standard of living when women used their role of housewife to create change through domestic politics. So again, Emily, welcome. We're so glad you said that you would discuss your book with us tonight.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
The meat strike, I guess we'll start at the meat strike of 1935. I was so impressed with the way the women got together when they found out they had a problem. They didn't just wander around and say, this is awful. And they really organized. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about the 1935 meat packer strike or the meat boycott?
The meat boycott strike.
Yes.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, the 1930s, I'm sure as your listeners are aware, was a time of incredible economic hardship, right? The women were in the midst of, you know, this is 1935, so year five of the Great Depression. Things were pretty bleak. Unemployment was very, very high. And as critical as we are today of the lack of a social safety net, there was even less of a social safety net in 1935, really none at all. It was, you know, really up to the goodwill of business owners and folks like Henry Ford to make donations to help out, you know, folks with food and the essentials. So, you know, these women are organizing in a time when folks are hungry, folks are unemployed, they're getting evicted from their homes. And they'd been seeing organizing happening already. You know, the Communist Party in the United States had been organizing neighborhood by neighborhood, and this was pretty common in Michigan and Detroit area where the 1935 meat boycott gets started. But you're right, the women didn't sit around talking about how crappy it was that meat costs a lot of money. They decided to organize, and it was led primarily in the beginning, by Polish housewives. Most of them, first generation, second generation, maybe born in the U.S., some immigrating, but most of them having been born in the U.S. And they lived predominantly in this town, which is a suburb of Detroit called Hamtramck, that is unique in that it is completely surrounded by Detroit as a city. So it's this little suburb within the boundaries of Detroit, very well known because it had a large Dodge plant there, a big car manufacturer. And so the women, you know, were frustrated at the high cost of living. They were also very frustrated that the government, the federal government, was making decisions to, rather than lower the cost of meat or mandate that the big three meat packers lower the cost of meat, that they were actually paying farmers around the country to destroy their livestock and not put it into the marketplace. And this infuriated the women. And so they began by organizing just locally boycotts, asking other women not to purchase, other shoppers who were predominantly women, not to purchase mostly beef. I mean, when we talk about meat, it's kind of synonymous with beef. We're not really talking about chicken here or fish. We're talking about beef specifically. Yeah.
Okay. And then you mentioned that the government was having farmers kill their livestock instead of sell it. That was the Agricultural Adjustment Act. That really had a lot to do with what they did.
Yeah, so, you know, I mean, their sort of political sophistication is impressive. You know, they were led by a woman named Mary Zuck, who is one of these women who had this sort of moment in the 30s of being very politically active and actually having kind of, you know, more than her 5 minutes of fame. She actually sort of generated a lot of notoriety throughout Michigan and then also nationally for a brief time around this boycott. And she, as the leader of the boycott, you know, really educated other women on the fact that this proposed Agricultural Adjustment Act, which the majority of it was later found to be unconstitutional, mm-hmm. was, you know, in essence paying farmers to destroy their livestock in the belief by the federal government that by flooding the you know, that it was going to be bad for farmers to have too much meat in the marketplace for consumers to purchase, and it would drive down the cost of meat and therefore wouldn't be good for anybody. To the protesters' perspective, you know, food is an essential thing that we all need, right? So it shouldn't it be the responsibility of the government to make sure that everybody who's living in the United States is able to afford and to eat a very sort of basic standard of living kind of meal, which in their mind included meat. And so there was a lot of frustration around that, a lot of frustration around how much meat was costing at the butcher shops. And this is, of course, a time when people are not going to their local grocery store. They're shopping, you know, at the vegetable stand, mm-hmm. with the meat at the butcher shop. They're getting their milk delivered at home. So they're going specifically to the butcher shop and picketing outside of butcher shops. It looks very much like a labor strike, you know, picket signs, mm-hmm. very same model, boycott. Petitions calling out on women to boycott. And this eventually spread to other Chicago Chicago. It did spread to Chicago, but in Michigan and Detroit, it spread to other neighborhoods. Of course, neighborhoods are very segregated by ethnicity and race. So the Jewish neighborhood was also boycotting. There were some more affluent suburban areas that believed that boycotting was maybe too extreme. So instead, housewives would sit outside the market and ask people to sign petitions that they would then send on to legislators to demand that they lower the cost of meat. And in the Black community as well, the housewives leagues were very active in organizing a meat boycott. So, you know, it wasn't just this one little kind of, you know, Polish enclave that was organizing it, although that is where it got its start. And ultimately, the boycott spread nationally. So the activists in Hamtramck decided to split up, and they sent some activists to Chicago to confront the meat packers, who, of course, had, you know, the stockyards in Chicago was the meatpacking capital of the world. And then another delegation went to Washington, D.C., to take on the Secretary of Agriculture and the federal government. And I think what's notable about the 1935 meat boycott isn't it's an interesting story for sure. It is not the first time women have boycotted meat and protested around food prices. That can be dated back to the American Revolution. Within the 20th century, kosher butchers were fell victim to boycotts by Jewish immigrants in the Lower East Side of Manhattan in 1902. And every decade since then, there was some kind of protest. What I thought was an important component to the 1935 meat boycott is that you see the protesters leaving their neighborhoods, going to Chicago, going to D.C., making this a much bigger story than just a battle between a neighborhood and their butcher, but really taking on both the meat packers and the federal government. And that differentiates the 35 boycott from previous protests around food in the 20th century. And so Mary Zuck, along with several other women, head to D.C., demand to meet with Secretary of Agriculture Wallace, sort of demanding that they stop killing the little piggies, I think is the sort of the language she uses. I was going to pull out a quote here from the book. Pull it up real quickly. You know, and the thing about Mary Zuck is, you know, she was not a seasoned activist. I mean, and I think that's what fascinated me about the whole element of consumer protest around food is that all of the activists that I found in my research weren't, you know, they weren't red diaper babies, right? Like they weren't born into the world of protest or labor unrest, but they did know what struggle was. And so Mary Zuck says around her lack of activism, and this is in the book on page 17, Zuck attributed her convictions during the meat boycott to her daily experiences of poverty. She says to the Voice of the People newspaper, which was a Polish language newspaper published in Hamtramck, "The misery of my childhood, the struggles I had later in life to raise a family in Hamtramck as a worker in the Dodge plant, all left their mark on me." She mentioned in the interview that she didn't think joining the meat boycott was anything, quote, unusual, but she noted, "I knew that if I wanted to protect my children, I had to protect the children of my neighbors and fellow citizens." And it was really that consciousness of collective action that drove so many of these protests. So they get to D.C., and Mary Zuck confronts the staff in Secretary Wallace's office, and she confronts him on the Agricultural Adjustment Act policy to pay farmers to destroy their livestock. And she says, Is the government going to see that my meat prices are reduced by 20%? That was their demand. Mm-hmm. And Secretary Wallace replies, you know, under drought conditions, it's impossible to guarantee future meat prices. She counters with, why does the government pay farmers not to raise little pigs? And I, you know, recently I heard a news story where there's very similar decisions being made on a national level where the government is, you know, where farmers are finding that they're having to destroy livestock because they aren't able to distribute it into the food system quickly enough. And so, for example, you know, a lot of meat processing plants right now are not set up to break down the meat to send to the grocery store, right? We don't go to the grocery store and buy, like, half a cow,
no,
right?
That's
or,
true.
You know, we want to show up with it all cut up and wrapped up in some plastic and not really think about where it came from, right? Now, restaurants often have deliveries of half a cow and they break that down how they want it. And a lot of meat packers that's how they distribute their meat. And so a lot of meat packers are finding that they're having to destroy their meat rather than get it out to people to feed, right? Rather than getting it out to the food pantries or distributing it to the grocery stores. And so I just struck, you know, by almost 100 years later, the stark similarities between, you know, federal policy. We didn't really learn our lesson, I guess, back in 1935. But, the 35 boycott is really a turning point for consumer protests, I would say.
And another thing during that period of time that I was reading, you talk a lot about the significance of meat in the diet of the working class. and that it really defined the American standard of living for a lot of immigrants, as well as just working class folks.
Yeah, I mean, meat is a class marker. I mean, it still is a class marker, right? I mean, for my family, it's like a big deal if we buy a steak, right? We don't eat steak every day. It's expensive, right? So, you know, but the belief was for many immigrants coming to the United States that they were coming to a world of plenty, you know? So for immigrants who were, you know, coming from Eastern and Southern Europe, often places where there are drought conditions, where they are persecuted and don't have access to food, or where they're poverty-stricken and can't afford to buy the food available to them, you know, the belief that coming to the United States was going to open up all of these financial opportunities, and with that meant you wouldn't experience hunger any longer, right? And and people ate meat on a regular basis, right? I mean, it's much more common now to meet people who don't eat meat, who are vegetarians, who only eat fish or chicken. But beef was is a major staple, right? And certainly in the Midwest, I would say that's still the truth today. And just reading quickly a little section out of the book, you know, I wrote that hunger represented a collective misery for Eastern and Southern European immigrants, as well as for African American migrants coming from the South to the North. With food carts loaded down with fruits and vegetables and butcher's windows full of fresh meat and the scent of fresh bread wafting from the neighborhood bakery, the American city promised an end to hunger for many. But, you know, that assumes that you are earning enough, one, to purchase those items, and two, that those items aren't outrageously priced. And meat also became this sort of symbolic good that both working and middle-class women used to protect the American standard of living. There's a belief that all people in the United States should have a certain standard of living, and meat was seen as critical to the ability for somebody to work. So, you know, the idea was that men, as the sort of representative worker, relied on meat, specifically beef, for the nutritional necessity to work. And there's, you know, even the AFL early on in 1900, Samuel Gompers, in a rather racist screed to support the Chinese Exclusion Act, wrote some reasons for Chinese exclusion: meat versus rice, American manhood against Asiatic coolism, which shall survive, right? So this idea that meat represented the ultimate in manhood and the ultimate in American identity, right? And that the Chinese stereotype, right, of eating only rice was one of those sort of messages that the early labor movement drove home when they were encouraging the Chinese Exclusion Act and the continuation of Chinese exclusionism in the United States. So you see this again and again in the labor movement, in popular fiction, references throughout American history, the importance of meat as a nutritional value, as a class marker, as symbolic of financial success and stability.
And that was, yeah, and that you really made that evident throughout the book. Another thing that happened in the 30s, and I know we kind of need to move on, but that was real interesting, is during the other protests and other strikes, the women, the union auxiliary, set up strike kitchens, child care centers, first aid stations, and they had the emergency brigades. That was really interesting. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about that? That was...
Sure. I mean, I think what's exciting about this time is this is my first time really talking about this book in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic, but it just struck, you know, this period of time in the 30s struck me as a period of great innovation and resilience, that women organized this around the need to provide certain services. And I see that happening in my community today around the pandemic, making sure that people have enough food and helping neighbors out in a way that, you know, in my almost 50 years, I've never seen before. So in the 1930s, when the auto industry was organizing unions, when the UAW was organizing, many of your listeners may know that in order to get the union recognized and to get the union contract at plants like the General Motors plant, which was the largest employer in the world,
Emily?
The workers took, yes, go
Emily,
ahead.
I wish we could go on. We should have booked you for the entire, for a full hour. But we have
stop.
Yeah. But thank you so much for being here. It was just so informative.
Sure.
Everybody needs to read this book. It's just really, it tells you a whole lot about our history and how great our women were who pushed things along. So anyway, thanks again. And we're going to move on to our next program.
KKFI is holding a virtual event on May 21st at 7 p.m. We invite you to join us online to watch the documentary film Rigged, The Voter Suppression Playbook, followed by a panel discussion moderated by Judy Ansel. She'll be joined by the filmmakers, Missouri Jobs with Justice, and ACLU of Kansas, talking about local efforts to expand the vote in Missouri and Kansas. This event is free, and when you RSVP at kkfi.org/rigged, you also get a link to watch the film ahead of time. It's May 21st at 7 p.m. to watch Rigged and learn from the panel. All the info is at kkfi.org/rigged.
Jaws of Justice Radio investigates how we can achieve justice from a system of laws deeply rooted in economic, political, and social inequality. We strive to dispel misconceptions created by the news and entertainment industries, as well as the fear-mongering of the political system. Listen in as we search out the tools needed to make our community a more just environment. Jaws of Justice Radio, Mondays at 9 a.m., right after Democracy Now!
I'm Tom Gipkin. I'm a member of CWA 6360. I will be hosting this segment of the show. Tonight, our guest is Jessica Padola. She is one of the hardest working people I know in the labor movement. She worked tirelessly, spending many days and nights away from her family, traveling to all corners of the state, educating and organizing both union and non-union voters on the need to overturn right to work. She was instrumental in getting out the vote. Her hard work led to an overwhelming 67% vote to repeal Missouri's right to work law in 2018. Jessica wears many hats. She is the president of the Greater Kansas City Coalition of Labor Union Women, Heartland Women in Trades, on the executive board of the Missouri AFL-CIO, the Greater Kansas City AFL-CIO, St. Louis Building and Trades, and the Sedalia Building and Trades. She believes in making a difference through political action and organization. She wants working people and families to have a voice in all levels of government. She's called Independence Home for 17 years, and Jessica, I want to welcome you to the show.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Well, tell us about yourself. Where are you from and what got you interested in the labor movement?
Well, I kind of grew up all over. My mom was a political operative, so we lived in several different states growing up. And, you know, we'd moved around quite a bit. I originally came back to Kansas City because my mom was sick. She was a brittle diabetic who had experienced renal failure. But, you know, I met a man, we fell in love, we got married, and we've stayed here to raise our family. I've always been interested in labor. My mom was an AFSCME member. My dad was a Teamster. I had done organizing campaigns on behalf of both SEIU and AFSCME in the Los Angeles region. I had done quite a bit of work around the periphery of labor, but in 2014, I was given an opportunity to make a career move to the International Union of Painters and Allied Trades, District Council 3 here in Kansas City, and I jumped at the chance. I'm married to a union plumber, so I understood really clearly what I would gain from that and the type of work I would be doing, and the important work I would be doing. So it was really easy decision for me to make to go to work for the painters, and probably the best career decision I could have ever made. I work for a union that is full of dedicated tradesmen and women looking to lead and be as progressive and bold as possible in the building trades. And so I was really lucky to get that job. And then, you know, we all knew what was happening and what was coming to us in 2016 when Chris Koster lost the governor's race. I don't think anybody expected it to be the first thing that Eric Greitens did as governor, but it was. And my boss understood that the best thing that he could do for the Right to Work campaign would be to release me to that campaign so that I could serve in a greater capacity. And so that's kind of how that happened.
Along that Right to Work fight, you were pivotal in the 2018 fight against Right to Work. You did travel to all corners of the state. You met with hundreds, possibly thousands of people. Can you tell us about that?
Well, Ryan Burke was the campaign manager for We Are Missouri. And Ryan at the time worked for the AFL-CIO. And we had worked together in Jeff City. And, you know, I think that he knew that if I could be a part of the campaign, that I would work my tail off. And that's exactly kind of how that happened. Mike Lewis asked my boss to release me. Todd did. You know, we had that campaign in two very distinct cycles. The first one was when we launched the petition to actually gather the signatures and put the referendum on the ballot. And that was definitely an all hands on deck kind of attempt. Tom, you'll remember very well, like, I saw a lot of every labor person, labor leader in this town. And if you didn't see my face, you were getting emails or text messages from me. We had a job to do, and that job was to qualify that referendum for the ballot. We did not anticipate qualifying in all 8 congressional districts in this state, and in fact, we were the first initiative petition to do so. We gathered signatures everywhere. We understood that everybody has a say in this fight, that Right to Work was really a kitchen table issue. It's a pocketbook issue. And everybody wanted their say. And, you know, we had people that would say to us, I'm in favor of Right to Work, but I think the people of Missouri should have the right to vote on that. And we were like, that's great. That's good. So it was really a two-part process. And after we turned these signatures in that beautiful August morning, we knew at the IUPAT that just because of the nature of labor and how we are, we all have day jobs. And so in September, I started working with the campaign on a limited basis, just helping out on the communication side, somebody to help cure content for their Facebook page and to develop content for Twitter and to make sure that people were still talking about it as we were gearing up for the campaign. And then I went back to work for We Are Missouri in January of 2018. And really didn't stop until that August vote happened. And I traveled to all parts of the state. And you know what I learned was that working people, whether they were Democrats or they were Republicans, wanted the ability to have a say in their own future in this state. And that was the same, you know, whether it was in Potosi or in Kansas City. You know, and frankly, we worked really, really hard to build a coalition of voters, unlike any coalition that this state has seen before or since. And I'm proud of the work that we did and the campaign that we built. There were a lot of unions in this state and in this country that helped out, whether it was campaign donations, feet on the street, releasing their staff to do really important work that made that victory possible. But it didn't, you know, it didn't come out of a 2-year campaign. We've been fighting Right to Work in this state for a decade.
Yes, we sure have.
One
of the things I noticed was that every single union participated at some point in the collection of signatures, turning in signatures. Everyone knew what was at stake. What did you take away from that experience?
That when we all stand together and put aside our little differences that we inevitably have in labor, that when we all stand together, we can accomplish really big things in a short amount of time. You know, don't forget that when we were collecting those signatures, we didn't know in August of 17 that we would be voting on that in August of 18. We could have had that vote in November of 18, and everybody participated. And, you know, we had retirees that couldn't go out and collect signatures, but instead they came to the Painters Hall 2 or 3 days a week to make copies of the petitions or to organize the petitions. We had apprentices that would show up and say, I'm taking petitions to my job site tomorrow. Please train me on how to get these signatures. We had retirees that set up desks in, you know, busy intersections down in Cass County. I'm thinking of our friend Dennis Hall, you know, gathering signatures. And that happened everywhere across the state. You know, I joke that I had to change my phone number after the Right to Work campaign because too many people in this state had it. And that's absolutely true. Labor leaders, labor members, community leaders, you know, pastors. I mean, they're just, everybody had my phone number, and it was to the point where I needed to do my work for the IUPAT. So I needed to change my phone number, but it shows you the power of everyone standing together and what we could accomplish. Mm-hmm. And the message that we sent was so loud that even though those same anti-worker interests file Right to Work again, the Governor Parson was pretty clear that he didn't have an appetite for that fight.
We're talking with Jessica Padula. She's a labor leader in Kansas City and statewide, and she has a lot of valuable insight in the labor movement. The result was 67%. Was that what you expected, or was it higher or lower?
It was higher. It was actually about 9 points higher than I had anticipated. I thought that we would win 58-42, but we just really outperformed in every corner of the state. Our get out the vote effort and our field operation, you know, was just phenomenal. And that was led by Jake Olson, who's the state director, the Missouri state director for SEIU, a man who really understands how to write a field plan and mobilize people, staff it up, get the vote out. You know, we did things in that campaign that we hadn't done in the state of Missouri before, or definitely labor hadn't done. We utilized peer-to-peer texting. We had local labor, local union coordinators from just about every labor union in this state. I think like 97 or 98% of labor unions sent mail to their members about the Right to Work fight. And, you know, even labor unions that are not as politically active, generally speaking, were engaged in this fight. And I think that after the Right to Work campaign, that we've kind of been able to build on some of that momentum. For sure, it cemented relationships for labor across this state. I think that we realize that we can't let our geographical differences keep us apart, that we have to be really cognizant of the fact that we know how to stand up and fight back, and we have to be ready and willing to stand up and fight back each and every time. But we also have to understand that campaigns cost a lot of money, and that Right to Work campaign was no exception. Why it's really, really, really important, it's critical that when labor unions are screening candidates and making those recommendations to their members, the members understand that when we talk to candidates, we're talking to them about issues that are important to us, whether that is your dispatcher's contract on a local level or prevailing wage on a state level. And we're going to support candidates that support our positions. And I wish that more of our members understood that, and that they understood that when we all stand together, we make a big difference. And you know, 1.5 million voters in this state can determine the future of this state. We just have to stick together.
Speaking of that, you were able to bring a coalition of union, non-union, the community, and a whole bunch of other groups to go out and to vote down Right to Work. What kind of an undertaking was that?
It was it was a big undertaking, but the best strategic decision that we made on the campaign side, frankly, was to understand the work that had already been done, to know our community partners that were already out there building grassroots coalition work, strategically partnering with organizations to move this ahead. You know, we set the tone for that at the very beginning when we filed the referendum with Rod Chappell, the president of the Missouri NAACP. This is an economic issue. It is not a labor issue. Right to work is an economic issue. So the only way to win is with a broad coalition. And the organization in this state that does the best job at building, maintaining, and empowering coalitions is Jobs with Justice. So we partnered with Jobs with Justice. Richard Von Glahn was their policy director. He came on to be the coalition director. And we worked together very hard to identify coalitions that needed to be built, to identify key partners that we needed at the table, to hear what they wanted to say, to hear what their ideas were, and also to help us craft the best campaign possible in Kansas City. For us, that was Pat Macklin Jones that came onto the campaign and really helped us build a strong coalition with African-American clergy members and churches. We worked really hard in the Hispanic community on the Kansas City side to kind of bring in a large percentage of Spanish-speaking voters. And on the St. Louis side, you know, we really reached out to the immigrant community and the Bosnians over there. And you know, it's really important to remember that we're all in this together. And if you are a worker in this state, regardless of whether or not you are an organized worker in this state, we feel like we're responsible for you. We feel responsible for your safety. We feel responsible for your paycheck. We feel responsible for your retirement and everything in between. You know, if somebody is out there painting and making $12 an hour and they're a 1099 employee and they get hurt, there's no safety net for that employee.
And they probably don't have medical.
Right. And they're my responsibility, just the same way as my members are. Because if somebody is out there making $12 an hour to paint, they're undercutting my members and my members' ability to work. It's much better to organize the unorganized so that we create a level playing field for everyone. And we very much approached the Right to Work Coalition with that same philosophy. Every worker in this state was our responsibility, whether they were an organized workforce or not, because Right to Work had economic ramifications beyond whether or not you were a labor member. And it was really important for us to get that message out. And I think we did a good job.
I do too. We just have about a minute and a half left. I would like you to talk about how important it is to protect clean Missouri. And what would you expect to see in a state where the districts are drawn competitively?
You know, Tom, if you look at statewide races in the state of Missouri, they're pretty close. Think about Coster Greitens, think about Jay Nixon, you know, even Auditor Galloway and Sandra McDowell. But if you look at the makeup of our legislators in Jefferson City, it is a supermajority. And I don't care what party you are. If you have a supermajority and you don't have to work with your colleagues, that's a bad prescription for the citizens of this state. And so, unfortunately, today, what date is today? Is the, I don't even know what date it is. Welcome to COVID-19 radio, ladies and gentlemen. Today, the Missouri Republican Party, led by a couple of St. Charles and St. Louis County representatives, will be sending SJR 38 to the ballot. This is a bill to overturn Clean Missouri. But that's not, like, that's bad. It's really bad. This legislature always, you know, if they don't like what you do, they will try to overturn the will of the people of Missouri. But what makes it even more egregious, what makes it so dangerous, is the way that they're going to count people. they're only going to count voters. So my children will not count when it comes to representation. They want to change what has been the American standard for counting the populace when it comes to apportioning districts. The most thing I've ever seen.
We are at the end of our time, and we at Heartland Labor Forum want to thank you for coming on the show tonight. And you are a leader in the labor movement, and you're an advocate for working people and those who don't have a voice as well. And I appreciate you coming on the show tonight. And we have more things I wanted to ask you, but we just ran out of time.
I'm sorry, I can be a little talkative sometime. Please, friends, check out Greater Kansas City Clue on Facebook and on the internet. We'd appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
Thanks.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
Good evening, Kansas City. This is Angie Williams with the Law Offices of Angela L. Williams with another edition of Know Your Rights. Today, in the midst of this corona chaos and the city reopening and the lockdown protest and all the hoopla about businesses requiring people to wear face masks before entering, there's been a lot of rumors floating around social media and whatnot related to whether or not a business requiring you to wear a mask is a violation of the Americans with Disabilities Act. In my opinion, it is not a violation of the ADA, which requires that businesses make reasonable accommodations for people that have certain disabilities or medical conditions, unless doing so would endanger the health or the welfare or the safety of employees or other shoppers. Specifically in the ADA, there's a section that says this part does not require a public accommodation to permit an individual to participate in or benefit from the goods, services, facilities, privileges, advantages, and accommodation of that public accommodation when that individual poses a direct threat to the health and safety of others. A direct threat in this act is defined as a significant risk to the health or safety of others that cannot be eliminated by a modification of policies, practices, or procedures, or by provision of auxiliary aids or services that are provided elsewhere in the statute. There's even language in the ADA to determine whether or not an accommodation creates a direct threat. So, in other words, an accommodation, there's a lot of people saying, and there's been even some cards that float around the internet that says that you can print this out and show it to a business and say you don't have to wear a mask under the ADA. The ADA specifically talks about direct threats, and it says, in determining whether an individual possesses a direct threat to the health and safety of others, a public accommodation must make an individualized assessment based on reasonable judgment that relies on current medical knowledge or the best available objective evidence to ascertain the nature, duration, and severity of the risk, the probability that the potential injury will actually occur, and whether reasonable modifications of the policies, practices, and procedures might be able to mitigate. So while it's true under the ADA, if you do have a medical disability and you don't have to tell people what the disability is, but the business is only, they don't have to permit you to not follow the rules that they set. They have to make reasonable accommodations, and in this reasonable accommodations, they need to determine whether doing accommodations that are being insisted upon by the person would constitute a direct threat to other people. In other words, a business doesn't have to grant an accommodation to your request if doing so would make it unsafe for others in a manner that poses a real threat. If you look at the most recent CDC guidelines related to the coronavirus, one of the big things that it talks about in helping prevent the spread of the disease is face masks. And that is not so much for me to be protected, but for me to be protecting other people in the event that I have it and am asymptomatic. So if you are one of those people that actually has a respiratory condition that makes them unable to wear a mask, the ADA requires businesses only need to make a reasonable accommodation for the disability, not necessarily the accommodation that the person requests. So that means if the person can't wear the mask and they aren't being allowed in the store, a store could offer to shop for the person and then bring it out to them. That would be an example of a reasonable accommodation that the person doesn't have to accept, but is what the accommodation is. The accommodation does not have to be, okay, you don't have to wear a mask. Similarly, threatening to sue businesses that are having you wear a face mask is not going to be helpful because, well, under the ADA, you don't have to disclose what your disability is. You do have to disclose the disability in the event that you have a lawsuit. Requiring people wear a mask is really no different than requiring people to wear shoes when you go into a store or to wear a seatbelt when you're in the car. But that is what my interpretation is of this ADA. So if you are someone who has an actual respiratory disability who actually cannot wear a mask, not just someone who doesn't want to wear a mask, you need to check with probably an ADA lawyer to see what reasonable accommodations might be. But most stores are offering various things like curbside pickup or having other people shop for you. Or, of course, there's other things like Postmates and Instacart and various other delivery grocery apps that also could be available. That's all the time we have tonight, Kansas City. This is Angie Williams with the Law Offices of Angela L. Williams with another edition of Know Your Right. Be safe and wear a mask.
All right, now for the calendar. Rigged, the voter suppression playbook film, is tonight with a panel discussion following. That's tonight at 7 p.m. for the film and 8:15 for the panel discussion. See kkfi.org for details. It's co-sponsored by KKFI, Missouri Jobs with Justice, and the ACLU of Kansas. Workers Unite Film Festival is now online. You go to workersunitefilmfestival.org to buy tickets. That happens from May 22nd to the 25th. And on Friday, there's a movie about the working conditions of postal workers called Gone Postal. Wyandotte County Third Saturday Breakfast is now online, so join this Saturday, I should say a week from this Saturday. No, it is this Saturday, May 23rd at 9 a.m. It is a Zoom, so the best way, I think, probably to find out about that, since Sharice Davids is one of the speakers, call her office or try her website for the Zoom instructions. Next week on the Heartland Labor Forum, Cuba, How Socialists Fight a Pandemic, and Christopher R. Martin, No Longer Newsworthy, How Mainstream Media Abandoned the Working Class. I'm Keith Washburn, tonight's engineer and standing in for Jen Zaman. I'll be back at 8 p.m. tonight with the local showcase. Jimmy Bratcher is our guest. Stay tuned right now for the Thursday night special.
So take it in stride. We've still got our pride. 'Cause we are the working class and that's the place to be.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss, and you can talk back too. Send us your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to heartlandlaborforumkkfi@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming schedule, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here at 90.1 FM KKFI.